This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up, it turns out that anger can be hazardous to our heart health, according to new research. A psychologist joins us to talk about how we manage our anger and the positive and negative roles it can play in our daily lives.
First, news out today about autism. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's latest estimates suggest that one in 68 U.S. children has autism. It's a 30% jump from the last federal estimate.
While that news may sound alarming, health officials say the numbers may not mean autism is occurring more often.
Here to explain is Maureen Durkin, professor of population health sciences and pediatrics at the UW-Madison. She's an investigator at the Weissman Center in Madison. Maureen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob.
Well, it sounds like a lot, one in 68 kids. Is this alarming? Is this a big jump in incidence of autism?
Yes, it is a large increase in the frequency of the condition. It's more than 1% of children now are being found to have autism, much higher than we'd ever expected.
So does this mean more kids are getting autism, or we're finding it more often now that we're looking for it more carefully?
Well, we do think that our tools for detecting autism have improved a lot, and the awareness is much greater, both among parents and providers, healthcare providers and teachers who work with children, know how to recognize it more than they did in the past. So certainly some of the increase over time seems to be due to that.
It seems like it's not a straightforward diagnostic. There's not just a blood test or something. What are the diagnostic tools that we're using to detect autism?
Well, they include screening tools so that now all children, when they go for their pediatric visits, undergo a screening process for developmental concerns in general. And these can be just systematic observations of the child's behavior and questions for the parents to answer. And then for children who screen positive, that suggests there might be a developmental delay, then they undergo a more detailed developmental assessment. And that includes systematic observations of their behaviors in specific settings.
Well, that CDC study was nationwide sampling parts of the country, I believe. What do things look like here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, we're one of the 11 sites participating in the CDC's autism surveillance. We've been doing this since 2002. And what we have found is since we first started out, the prevalence has just about doubled here in Wisconsin among 8-year-old children. And so at this point, it's about 1% of children are found to have autism in Wisconsin. It's a little lower than the national estimate, which is closer to 1.5%.
So once we've diagnosed autism, a child has autism, what's next? Do we just know that, or are there treatments, therapies out there?
Yes, there's lots of therapies, particularly behavioral interventions. And the idea is that these are most effective if they begin early in life. So there's a big effort to try to identify autism earlier rather than waiting till the child gets to school age. And these are therapeutic. The most common treatment for autism is an intensive behavioral one-on-one types of interventions. And these can be very costly. The cost is about $50,000 a year per child receiving these services.
Are we getting better at providing this kind of therapy?
I don't know that we're getting better. I think that as we realize the need is greater, we're finding it a little bit harder to meet the need with our given levels of training and resources.
Have we gotten any closer to determining what causes autism?
No, not much. We're learning more and more that there's some genetic mutations that explain a small percentage of cases of autism. There's a number of risk factors we're learning about. One of the ones we've found is that children born to older parents tend to have a higher rate of autism. But this is just one contributing factor. Still, most of the children born to older parents do not have autism, but it does increase the risk somewhat. Also, children born prematurely have a higher risk of developing autism, and there are other risk factors like that.
It seems like one challenge from a public health perspective is that we might see a state or even an urban community looking like an autism hotspot, more diagnoses there. But the question would be, does that mean there's more autism there or there's better autism detection there?
I think that's a really good question, and we don't know the answer to that yet. There could also be a tendency for migration of people to areas where there are better services, and that might explain why we find in some urban areas more autism than in rural areas.
I know there's been some controversy from the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, I think it's called,
yes,
about defining the autism spectrum. You used to either have no autism, autism, or you might have something on that spectrum in between. Is that still a diagnosis?
Yes. The categorization of autism has changed over time somewhat, and we no longer, according to the latest DSM manual, we don't subdivide the different types so much. We call it more broadly an autism spectrum condition, and the severity can range widely within it.
And does the therapy vary with the severity?
Yes, of course it does. And some of the children with autism also have other behavioral problems that can respond to medication. So many of the children are receiving medications for some of their behaviors.
So if a parent is concerned, maybe they've had preliminary diagnosis of possible autism, they're just worried but maybe don't have access to health coverage, what is a next step if a parent suspects autism?
Well, there's the most important thing is to let their health care provider know about their concerns. And all children in the state of Wisconsin should have access through birth to three programs, early intervention programs that serve children around the state, to some kind of health care intervention, regardless of their insurance status. And then in addition, once they reach school age, they can receive services for autism through the school system. And for children with disabilities, they become eligible at age 3 for those services through the school system.
And so how do they proceed then? If they've got that diagnosis, they want to go through the school to get that service or look around. Does Wisconsin have a clearinghouse where people can find all the info they need?
Yes, they can definitely find the information through the Birth to Three program for the state of Wisconsin. The Waisman Center here also has a resource center and lots of information available online for this.
With a number like 1 in 100 kids with autism in Wisconsin, 1 in 68 around the country, do you see that lighting a fire under the butts of policymakers, the health community, to do more, to make sure there are more services, more diagnostic opportunities out there?
Yes, I think it should do this. We've been thinking that the rate of increase might level off and we could settle down and then begin planning that. But so far we've seen no leveling off. The numbers just keep increasing. And the availability of services for the children is not up to par with what the numbers are showing, so we do need to do a lot more.
We'll leave it there for now. Maureen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Maureen Durkin. She's a professor of population health sciences and pediatrics at the UW-Madison. She's an investigator at the Waisman Center in Madison. She joined us today to discuss new CDC numbers estimating that 1 in 68 kids in the U.S. have autism. A new study shows some serious health risks from getting angry. According to this study from Harvard, the risk of heart attack or related coronary problems is multiplied by 5. The risk of stroke quadrupled in the 2 hours after an angry outburst. While researchers say, hey, don't panic about that elevated risk, it still does make a significant difference.
So what do we do with all of that information? As you know, it's not always easy to control anger, and perhaps anger can have some positive functions too. Ryan Martin joins us now. He is chair of the psychology department at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, where, among other things, he studies the psychology of anger. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hello. Good to be here.
It's nice to have you along. I want to start out with these health implications. You know, all along, I think I always suspected that, you know, if somebody got real angry, their chances of having a heart attack or some sort of event like that would occur. And now it seems as though that's been confirmed. I mean, is this something that people have sort of suspected for a long time?
Yeah, I think what this study seems to bring that is new is the finding that it happens, that it can cause an immediate risk. You know, we've known that chronic anger problems led to chronic health problems for a very long time. But what this study really brings that's fascinating is the idea that having an angry outburst actually puts you at risk, you know, within those next couple of hours. And I think you're right. That is something we've suspected, but this is more substantial proof of that.
Well, Ryan, we tend to think of anger as a negative emotion, and this health news hammers that home even more. But Does anger have a positive side?
Absolutely. So I'm of the opinion that all emotions have a positive side, that they exist because they bring us kind of an adaptive benefit. Anger's adaptive benefit is that it alerts us to the fact that we've been wronged, and it actually energizes us to confront that injustice. And so if somebody's wronged us, it gives us the energy to respond to that and to do something about it.
I want to ask, too, it seems as though people are angry more often these days, and I'm wondering whether that's just a perception that's going around or whether there's been any research on that.
I think that's a common perception, and so that's something I hear often from people, this idea that people are angrier now. I tend to wonder if it isn't that anger is a little more visible than it ever has been before. One of the areas that I've started researching recently is anger on the internet, and I think the internet provides many different venues for people to vent and to express how angry they are, and they're more permanent than they used to be. The person who used to just get angry while they were sitting in their car stuck at a stoplight, now later on, posts about it in Facebook or tweets about it, and then it's more permanent. And so we end up seeing it more that way.
It's also more immediate, right? I mean, you can just fire something off before you think about it.
Yep, absolutely. I think that's one of the problems that we see with anger online, is that it exacerbates impulsivity problems. I sometimes wonder if what we see right now, and especially online, is an anger problem, an impulsivity problem, or both. We see that because you can fire off an email, because you can post or tweet something so quickly, you don't necessarily have time to think about it and cool down before you do it.
I wonder, though, once upon a time, the anger was, Gene, you just hit me in the head with a rock. I am immediately mad at you. Now it's, Gene, you express something on Twitter that doesn't accord to my personal values. And when I think about it a little bit, I get angry. I don't know. It seems like there's more distance. There's more steps there toward that anger. Does that matter?
Yeah, I think to go to that question you asked before about are people angrier now than they used to be? I think there's probably some truth to that too, and I think some of it is what you're describing there with the multiple steps, that there are lots of things out there that we can kind of find and seek out that make us angry, and I think the internet provides a place for that. Somebody posts something that's incongruent with your belief system. That was maybe something that was hidden in the past, something people, friends didn't necessarily talk about, but it's harder not to talk about it now because it gets posted out there or put out there.
I want to talk a little bit about the process of anger. I read a column that you wrote where you talk about we think of anger as being the sort of this impulsive thing that just sort of happens when we're in the car and somebody cuts us off and, this thing, some bad words happen. But the way you outline the process, there's a little more complexity to it than just that.
Yeah, I think what we see is that, and that's really common. People think of anger as being this thing that just happens, right? And usually it's, it happens to us almost, right? Something makes us mad. But ultimately, it doesn't really work that way. If it did, then two people would respond to provocations in exactly the same way, and we know that doesn't happen. It ends up being the result of, yes, there's a trigger event. There's usually something that happens that sparks it. But it's that trigger event interacts with our individual characteristics, so, personality traits, things like that, things like narcissism, things like competitiveness, those sorts of traits matter. But also what kind of mood we're in at that point when it happens. If you're, running late for work, that stoplight, getting stuck at that stoplight is a lot worse than if you're just out for a Sunday drive. So the kind of mood we're in matters. People are more likely to anger when they're tired. They're more likely to anger when they're sort of physically uncomfortable, when they're, when they're under stress and so forth. All of those things really play a role. But I think the big thing and how those things all matter is that they matter with regard to how we appraise events or how we evaluate events. And they matter with regard to whether or not we look at something and we kind of we evaluate the situation. Do we think that this is unjustified? Do we think that this is unnecessary? Do we think it's blameworthy, and so forth? And so, you know, if we're driving along and, you know, someone could have gone through the, you know, made it through a stoplight but stopped short, and now we don't get to go through the stoplight either, you know, when we're tired, when we're frustrated already, when we're stressed, we may evaluate that behavior much more negatively. We may say, oh, well, that person is, you know, they shouldn't have done that. Sometimes people even take it a step further to be a little more extreme where they say things like, oh, he just did that to make me mad or something like that.
Well, supposing we're one of those people with personality traits that makes us more prone to anger, are we doomed? I mean, that's just how we are, and we're always going to have a quicker hair trigger toward anger than everyone else?
Absolutely not. We see that people can routinely, you know, make changes. And, you know, I think one of the things we know is that human beings can change. Now, the degree to which they can change is always somewhat limited, right? People don't just change overnight, and they don't change dramatically overnight, that's for certain. But we know that people can, once people start to be a little more introspective, once they start to think a little bit about what's making them angry, why they're feeling angry, when they start to evaluate the types of thoughts they have when they're angry, we see that people can make noticeable differences in kind of how they experience anger and so on.
Well, some of the things you just mentioned make me think of the word mindfulness. Is there,
yes.
Do people meditate to become less angry or practice other mindfulness kind of things? Does that work?
Absolutely. That's and it works in two ways. Or there's two ways in which we find that mindfulness is valuable. For starters, we see that, you know, there's been a lot of research on mindfulness and how it helps with, you know, essentially with relaxation, the same way mindfulness helps, you know, decrease anxiety and that sort of thing. We tend to think of anger and relaxation as being what we call incompatible mood states, that you can't feel both at the same time. And so if you can, through mindfulness or other relaxation approaches, achieve a point where you're feeling relaxed, well, then that anger starts to dissipate. The other way it works, though, that is really important is that one of the things we see from chronically angry people is they tend to just kind of brood on events and think about events over and over and over again. And they ruminate is what we call it. And so it's the person who, you know, maybe they get in an argument with someone and then they just can't let it go, and they think about it and they think about it and they think about it. And, you know, as they're trying to go to sleep that night, they continue to think about it. Well, we found that mindfulness can really help people who tend to ruminate. It can really help them think about or help them sort of achieve a little bit more inner peace. And so they can let some of those thoughts go.
So given that news that we started this interview out with, that there are some health implications to getting angry, you know, particularly in the first couple of hours after the event, does this whole idea of being mindful, of being cognizant of your emotions, take on greater urgency?
I think it does. And I think, you know, to kind of go back to something I said earlier, I don't think anger on its own is particularly bad. I think anger is a really valuable emotion. But the next step isn't just what you feel, it's what you do with it. And it's one thing to feel angry. It's another thing to feel angry and then respond with aggression or respond with violence or to ruminate or things like that. And so I think a person who becomes angry and then can find a way to turn that into something a little more healthy, maybe they use that as a way of problem solving. Maybe they use that to assert themselves in a more respectful, responsible way than the kind of aggressive way we tend to think about. A person who's willing to do those things when they get angry or to embrace mindfulness, I think that can be really healthy and valuable.
We're talking to UW Green Bay psychology professor Ryan Martin about anger, and more specifically, we're talking about some recent research which suggests that there are some health implications to getting angry, specifically a higher risk of heart attack and stroke right after, in the hours after, an angry outburst.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
We're talking about anger and being mad as tech and what we can do about our anger before it hurts our health. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. UW Green Bay psychology professor Ryan Martin is with us to talk about the role that anger plays in our lives, and we'd like you to join in. Have you figured out how to rein in your anger? Is there a situation in your life, maybe it's driving, maybe it's work, watching the big game, whatever it might be, where you find yourself getting angrier than you like? Give us a call and tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, talk@WPR.org.
Ryan, we hear sometimes we shouldn't bottle our anger up. We need to vent it. I think there have even been therapies involving screaming, punching pillows, that sort of thing. We've got to get it out of our systems. Is there anything to that?
There is something to it. It's actually the opposite of that, though. what you're referring to is, we oftentimes in the field refer to as the catharsis myth, the idea that venting anger that way is good for us, is what we need. It's, you know, the pressure cooker metaphor. And ultimately what we find, though, is that people who, you know, vent, people who hit pillows, people who hit, you know, punching bags and things like that as a way of expressing their anger, ultimately have more serious anger problems down the road. An old soccer coach of mine used to say, practice makes permanent, not practice makes perfect, but permanent. Mm-hmm. And his point was that if you practice something incorrectly, that's how you're going to do it down the road. And that's, I think, what's happening with this idea of catharsis, that if you tend to fall back and develop an anger expression strategy that's unhealthy, well, then that's what you're going to do all the time. And, you know, yelling, screaming, punching things, those just aren't healthy anger expression approaches for the most part.
So, which brings up the question of what is a healthy anger expression?
I think, to be honest, the healthiest, the right thing to do when you're angry is really very much contextual. You know, it depends on the situation. I think, by and large, what I usually encourage is that, you know, the things you should be trying to do for the most part is, one is sort of stop, reflect on the situation to the best that you can in the moment. Think about why you're feeling angry. Think about some problem-solving approaches. You know, what is it? You know, I'm feeling this way because something is wrong, is a way, another way of thinking about it. Is there something I can do to fix whatever is wrong? You know, is there a way in which I can assert myself calmly? Maybe not now. Maybe it's, you know, to wait a little while and then to come back and assert myself and say, this is why I got angry. This is what I would like to see happen. I think the key is, and probably the hardest part of this entire process, though, is catching yourself in the moment, is recognizing, you know, first that you don't want to lose control that way, and recognizing that you need to kind of step back a little bit. And that can be really, really hard for people, really difficult for people to be able to step back that way.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Good afternoon. As I told the screener, I think you can choose as an individual whether or not you're going to get angry or not. You should be able to control yourself. I'm older. Actually, I'm being treated right now for PTSD and from being in a war. And one of the things that they are really working on is helping us to control our anger, keep things in perspective. Everybody likes to talk about the anger that they feel while they're out there on the road, and you can see it. How something silly, somebody just doesn't do something that the person behind them thinks is right, and they just explode. And you have to keep things in perspective. You have to realize that everything that happens to you and around you out there on the road or wherever is not personal. It's not something personal, and you just have to calm down, relax, take a deep breath, keep things in perspective, and you also have to remember and realize that, you know what, you screw up a lot too. You know, you're not perfect.
Mike,
and I think that
Mike, thank you so much. Good luck with your treatment for PTSD. A couple of really interesting things there, I thought, Ryan, and I wanted to bring you in on. First of all, the idea of anger as a choice.
Yeah, I think there is some truth to that. I mean, I think that there are times when I think anger is a very natural response. You know, I think that it happens as a, you know, as a result of the, like we said before, the combination of the situation and also how you tend to appraise things. But I think the fact that we play a role in appraising things does suggest that we have some choice there, that there's something we can do. to feel differently about it. I think it might be sometimes the way it's presented, that idea that anger is a choice, makes it seem like it's a light switch or something, and that, I think that's probably a little too simplistic. Not, you know, that's not what the caller said, but I think that's a little too simplistic. But there is, I mean, we play a role in whether or not we're going to get angry, that is for sure.
Let's go back to the phones right now. Rebecca is with us from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. My question is about the inability to express anger. I'm someone who is very calm and can recognize when I'm being wronged or that something isn't going my way, but I'm wondering about the health risks associated with the inability to express anger.
Rebecca, great question. What about that, Ryan? What about someone who just holds it in, but inside there's sort of this seething cauldron of, you know, burning bile or whatever is inside there?
Yeah, and that is, you know, that is most certainly a problem too. And I'm glad she called and brought that up. I think, you know, there's obvious, you know, back to when I said that the right thing to do when you're angry is, you know, depends on the context. I think there is a time and place when you want to hold it in, but just like if you were always to hold it in, the same way if you were always to express it sort of aggressively, you would, you know, it wouldn't be healthy. We see that, you know, chronic anger suppression like that is still associated with long-term cardiovascular problems. It's also associated with other sorts of negative emotions. Sometimes people feel guilty. They feel, you know, frustrated with themselves for not, you know, telling a person how they felt. That's where a lot of that rumination comes from that I mentioned before, that a person who feels like, I really should have told that person that I was mad at them. That you know, and then they continue to think about it and sort of stew. I don't worry. I mean, sometimes people will sort of blow their top eventually, but even if they don't, it's still really unhealthy to kind of hold that in all the time because it causes other sorts of psychological and physiological problems down the road.
Rebecca, thanks a lot for bringing that up. We've got Steve on the line now in Winona. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Oh, I wanted to make a comment to the guest. So in my experience, any time I have been angry, the only time I've felt any positive feeling about the discussion when I had been angry is if the other person was calm and found a reason in my behind my anger. So having observed that, I use a very simple technique that work most of the time when I feel that I am getting to the verge of anger, is to simply try to count slowly in my mind to 5, and that usually calms me down, and also try to engage in the conversation by not so much as responding to the other person, but trying to ask them more questions.
Huh. Interesting. So counting and then asking questions instead of really confronting as such, Ryan.
Yeah, counting is a really good anger control strategy. You know, and it takes someone who is aware of the fact that this is where the choice piece comes in. A person who is aware of the fact that they want to be calm and acknowledging, yes, I want to relax right now. So making the point of, you know, stopping themselves, counting to 5, probably taking some deep breaths while they do it, and then moving forward in kind of a more calm manner. The idea about asking questions, I think, makes sense as well. And you know, asking questions can still be a means of sort of asserting yourself as too. You know, that as you're asking those questions, you're probably asking questions with an idea in mind about how you'd like the person to answer them. And so that can still be kind of a conflict resolution approach.
In about the last minute or so, is the research we're talking about today, that health implication of getting angry and, you know, the chance of increased heart attacks and stroke, is that a game changer here, or is this just part of the evolution of our research into anger and some of its effects?
I wouldn't necessarily call it a game changer in the sense that it's consistent with the other stuff that we've known. I think the way in which it's a game changer is that I think it makes it even more clear that an angry outburst can have really negative effects. That, you know, in the past, we tend to think of an angry outburst as meaning that people might be at risk of being the victim of violence or something like that, a person hurting themselves or hurting someone else. Now I think we're adding that there are immediate health consequences. And so in that sense, I think it is a game changer.
Well, Ryan, thanks for joining us today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
That was Ryan Martin, chair of the psychology department at UW Green Bay.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Veronica Ricker.
Time now for our state news roundup with news guy Noah Ovshinsky. He also answers to the title Assistant News Director. Noah, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
Well, big news in the governor's race, a new jobs plan from the challenger, a Democrat, Mary Burke. What does it look like?
Right. So this was something that certainly the press was waiting for. The Walker campaign had been criticizing the Burke campaign because they hadn't released a jobs plan yet. And that was, in fact, released this week. There weren't a lot of specifics. The plan really just sort of lays out what her goals are more than anything else as far as job creation is concerned.
It's more mission statement stuff as opposed to practical legislation, say, that might be introduced.
Exactly. And really the headline for this story, if there was one, was that unlike Governor Walker, she shied away from providing a specific number of jobs she wanted to create and instead simply said that she wanted the state to rank in the top 10 among states for economic growth. Governor Walker has been criticized over the course of the last few years because it's not looking like he's going to make his goal that he set for himself of helping the state create 250,000 jobs by the end of his first term.
Before we get into some of the details, such as they are, of Mary Burke's plan, I mean, you're kind of darned if you do, darned if you don't. You can be criticized from either side for not having a plan, but then once you put a paper out there, you've given lots of specific ammunition that the other side can key in on.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, jobs are going to be, if not the theme of this campaign, one of the major themes in the coming months. And so it was just a matter of time before this plan was going to be released.
So looking to be in the top 10 list for economic growth, what did Mary Burke call for? What were the main themes?
Yeah, she wants to direct the state resources to specific clusters of industries. And when I say clusters, I mean these are businesses that produce, you know, similar products. They use the same supply chain, that sort of thing. We're talking about the paper industry or agricultural machinery, both of those very big industries in Wisconsin.
And, you know, we won't ever probably be as specific industry focused as, say, the auto industry and all the supporting industries in Michigan, but just trying to develop that kind of regional strength, I guess?
Exactly, and build on the momentum that we already have as a state in these specific industries.
Gotcha, and not suddenly make us the leading Alpenhorn producer for the world.
Exactly.
Okay, other highlights of Mary Burke's plan.
Yeah, she also talked a little bit about college education. She said that in her plan that she'd like college education to be more affordable for students in Wisconsin, and that's sort of as a way of increasing the number of college graduates and thus the number of people who can enter the workforce in this sort of modern economy. She also talked about the need to grow the state's base of entrepreneurs. Again, not really a specific strategy, but a goal. Also under that category is something she included in her jobs plan, that is to increase Wisconsin's global exports, which she has identified as a goal and, frankly, is probably a goal and would be of a goal of any governor
for any
in Wisconsin,
governor, right,
in any state in this country.
Well, what is the response from the current governor, her opponent in the upcoming election?
Sure. So the Walker campaign, of course, responded, and it basically was a continuation of arguably the biggest message they are trying to get across, which is that Mary Burke is a return to the failed policies of the past. They've gone, in the last several months, gone to great lengths and will continue to go to great lengths to link her to former Governor Doyle, whose administration she worked in.
You know, when all is said and done, governors, candidates talk a lot about how they are going to try and change the economy. Do governors, is there a consensus that governors make that much difference?
Yeah, good question. So all of what we just talked about, all of that being said, you know, many economists will tell you that governors in both parties, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, that at the end of the day, they actually can do very little to create jobs or improve the economy, that it's largely forces beyond their control that really affect things like job creation and the overall state of the economy. You know, that's the reality, according to these economists. You know, of course, we're talking about politics. So, you know, job creation matters, And it has been and will continue to be really a major theme in this race, whether or not at the end of the day, whether Governor Walker or candidate Burke can actually, you know, affect the job creation in the state.
Well, let's keep talking about politics with the newest edition of the Marquette University Law School poll from Charles Franklin. What are we seeing in the race for governor in that survey?
Right. So this latest poll showed that the race for governor hasn't really changed all that much. And that actually tells you a few things. And I'll throw out a few numbers just so that our audience, when I say it hasn't really changed, they have some numbers to go with. And according to this poll, Governor Walker is 7 points ahead of Mary Burke, 48% to 41%. What's interesting is that those numbers have held steady despite the fact that both sides are now beginning to air ads, which have a tendency to make a dent in these kinds of numbers. So a little surprising that maybe those numbers haven't changed since the last poll, or at least haven't changed dramatically. You know, now those ads, as well as campaign stops, will only grow in number, of course, in the coming months. So I expect at least some movement as we move into the summer and early fall.
Well, let's look at how people are looking at the candidates. First, Mary Burke. What do people think of her? Do people think of her so far?
Right. And you characterized it just the right way. The poll did reveal some interesting things about each candidate. For Mary Burke, 19% of people had a favorable view of Burke, while 22% had an unfavorable view. Now,
carry the one.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, now you add those up and it doesn't even come close to 100% or even 50%. So that means there are a lot of people out there who don't know enough about Burke to have an opinion one way or the other.
So she's not a household name. In that position, a candidate, what are they trying to do to introduce themselves to people?
Name recognition, name recognition, name recognition. That is the name of the game to some extent. Obviously, you know, the governor has the benefit of being an incumbent. You know, his name is out there. He's in the news every day. Mary Burke has not been in the news for a long time. So really, the goal for her and her campaign is to get out on the campaign trail, get out into every area of the state, and introduce her to the rest of the state, because really they have to define her in the eyes of those, say, 50%+ of people who don't have an opinion. It's their job to define Mary Burke for them. If they don't do it, the Walker campaign certainly will try their best to control the message and affect what those 50%+ of people have to think or the way that they think about Mary Burke.
And then what about Scott Walker? I believe the survey asked people, how's he doing? How's his job of performance?
Yeah, so this was also interesting. In January, 51% approved of how Walker handled his job and 42% disapproved. Now, in this latest poll, 47% approved and 47% disapproved of the way he's handled his job. So, you know, his job handling percentage, that's on a downward trend. Not much, but it's still downward, and it's early, but that's probably a bit of a red flag for his campaign.
Any other highlights of the survey outside of that matchup?
Yeah, two other questions that I found to be illustrative as far as, you know, where the state currently is. They also had to be making their way through the courts as we speak right now, so two very relevant issues. One is the poll found that 60% favor a voter ID law. That's a law that's currently being litigated right now. And 72% of those polled support either gay marriage or civil unions. 24% said there should be no legal status for gay couples. Again, another issue that's currently being fought out in court. So, you know, as rulings come down in these cases, which could happen this year, you know, these are very helpful numbers to keep in mind to put it all in context.
All right. And then finally, Governor Walker signed some of the legislation that's been coming out of the end days of this session. He's got some election-related action that he signed.
Yeah. So some significant news for voters, especially in Milwaukee and Madison, and Democrats in particular. Governor Walker signed into law legislation this week that ends weekend voting. And, you know, since taking office, Walker has slowly, and the legislature, has whittled away at this kind of voting. Before he took office, it was allowed on 3 weekends. The last legislative session, he and Republican lawmakers shrunk that to 1 weekend, and now no weekend voting will be allowed.
That's how it came through the legislature. Did he tweak that law in any way?
Yeah, he did. He used his veto power to partially veto a provision that would have limited early voting to 45 hours a week. The hours in which voting can take place is still limited, though, to between 8 a.m. and 7 p.m. So the veto had their practical effect of increasing the amount of hours to 55 per week.
And so what are the arguments for and against here?
Right. So critics argue that this kind of legislation is a form of voter suppression, that they're just trying to minimize the number of voters who go to the polls and vote Democratic, because it's largely Madison and Milwaukee who take advantage of this kind of early voting, and they largely swing Democratic. Republicans, on the other side, though, argue that, you know, this is about equalizing access to the polls, that, you know, just because Madison and Milwaukee have early voting, you know, doesn't mean other places in the, around the state can have it as well. And so this is about sort of equalizing the playing field.
Well, in the $10,000 pyramid category, things that will end up in courts that you mentioned earlier, this is probably one of them.
Absolutely. This is not the end of the story. The liberal group One Wisconsin Now says they are exploring their legal options. So at the end of the day, like a lot of the controversial legislation that has been passed in recent years, you know, this too may end up in court.
Is there a sense of public opinion on this?
Yeah. So according to the latest Marquette University poll, which we talked about earlier in the interview, 66% were in favor of early voting that included at least one weekend, if not more. At least based on this poll, you know, it seems like the legislation that was just signed into law by the governor and supported by the legislature, that it, you know, goes against public opinion or the majority of voters in the state.
All right. Another one to watch as we move ahead toward the election. Noah, thanks for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
Noah Ovshinsky is WPR's assistant news director. He joins us each week at this time to bring us up to date on the latest news from around Wisconsin.
Coming up, a new book makes the case that atheists have made major contributions to human history and progress. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Remember, you can keep up with Central Time on our Facebook page. We are Central Time on WPR, on Twitter, at Central Time WPR. Stick around, there's more to come. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.